This is the State of Things from the Upstage Cabaret at Triad Stage in Greensboro. I'm Frank Stacio. Thank you. Well, you know, there are a lot of reasons that you can give for not wanting to have kids. Overpopulation, life is hard, who wants to bring a child into that? Not to mention just the overwhelming desire to do what you want to do whenever you want to do it. Drew Perry offered explanations just like that to his wife, but he lost the battle. Twice. So, to work through his fear of having children, he wrote his newest novel, Kids These Days, and it addresses his own anxieties about becoming a father. Drew Perry is a professor of creative writing at Elon University, and he is the author of Kids These Days, and he's with us live in Greensboro. Drew, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
So tell me about these anxieties about having kids.
We would be at cocktail parties when my wife was first pregnant, and my friends who knew what I do for a living would ask me, you know, what's the new novel about? And I would tell them it's about a man who's agreed to have a child without actually agreeing to want to have that child. And I would act as though that was hilarious, and our friends would sort of slink away and leave me standing there with my angry wife drinking club soda. We'd go back home and do our sort of separate orbits around the house and the ritual of apology.
Did any of this come up during the dating process?
You know, I think I probably always knew I wanted to have a child at some point. You know, I'd want a 12-year-old to whom I could explain the infield fly rule at some point. But I wanted that 12-year-old, you know, in 12 years somewhere out there in the future. But unfortunately, there's a process that takes about 12 years and 9 months for that to happen.
So. Right. And those stories are a lot better to remember than actually to live, it turns out. So tell us about the... So what were you worried about?
Exactly as you said. I was, you know, I think fundamentally I was a pretty selfish person. I really liked being able to stay up late and watch that 10:30 West Coast baseball game that I didn't really have to care about because it has American League teams. And I like to be able to eat cereal on my own time. And I was never afraid of the sort of changing of diapers. That seems a pretty straightforward process. It's like cleaning a kitchen counter, just a little bit more disgusting. But I think also in addition to the selfishness, I was just terrified. The notion of being responsible for somebody else's life or partially responsible is a fairly horrifying prospect. And now that we've got kids, it turns out that it's every day. It's every single Tuesday and every single Wednesday for the rest of your life. He's going to have these questions that don't have any answers.
You know, Robin Williams described that diaper process as the contents, anyway, is 90% Velcro and 10% toxic waste. So it turns out that it's less attractive than you might think. Well, so these are the anxieties, these are the fears that you're having, and then you decide to write a book. So tell us a little about the book itself.
Well, I think it would be a little bit too navel-gazing just to write a book about a man who's sitting on his sofa freaking out about not having his Tuesdays to himself anymore. And so Walter, the main character in the book, I made him a mortgage counselor because what he's fundamentally worried about in having a child is that his life is going to evaporate, or his life as he knows it is going to evaporate. And it occurred to me that it would be interesting to give him a job that also evaporated. So he's one of the good mortgage counselors. I'm certain that there were some out there in this sort of collapse. Some of you may be. But so his job evaporates. His life is getting ready to evaporate, and they move to Florida so that he can take a job with his brother-in-law, Mid, who presents as a sort of small-time entrepreneur but may, in fact, be a semi-competent, low-grade crime boss.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a certain amount of entrepreneurship in that, isn't there?
Absolutely.
Keeping it going. But this is all part of it. It's kind of the reality that also that you're going to bring kids into, that what appears to be sort of normal and easy is actually a pretty turbulent world that these kids are growing into.
Right. I mean, that's the problem. You can, to a certain extent, you can control what happens within the four walls of your own house, but then the outside world begins to intrude. And those are the sort of two threads that I wanted to bring through this novel, was just sort of Walter's general fear about how to protect, how to raise a child, and then this outside world pressing in, you know, as the novel progresses and the caper, the sort of crime caper, becomes more and more substantial, his discovery that he's not going to be able really ever to know what's coming next.
Will you read for us?
Oh, sure. This is a section that takes place, they're living in a beachfront condo, and he's sort of looking around at the folks who live next door. What the vacationers did: sit on the beach, read, make sure the kids didn't drown in the surf, sit by the pool, drink, adjudicate Marco Polo disputes. Sometimes on a Wednesday, the beach would go quiet and empty itself out, all the renting families off to St. Augustine for a carriage tour or down to Marineland to watch the dolphins jump through hoops. The cars came back with dolphin-shaped bumper stickers, "I've been to Marineland." 4th of July, big fireworks in St. Augustine, bigger ones down south toward Daytona, the sky lit up on both edges. On the beach, people shot off squealers, screamers, 6x6 cubes with names like Smiling Dragon and Happy Family. dads and kids hunched into the wind trying to light matches, 10 tries for every one they got lit. Then the scatter and scramble for safe distance, the thing going off too soon, the laughing, the apologies, the promises not to do it again. Then they'd do it again. Alice and I sat on the balcony and celebrated our own independence. She was showing more, a quarter moon there at her waistline, and said she was sure she felt the BOJ, the bundle of joy, kicking. I couldn't feel it. Hold still, she said. That right there, you don't feel that? I told her I wanted to. You will, she told me. Don't worry. Soon.
Drew Perry reading from his novel, Kids These Days. So, and I think part of the anxiety is just how, again, you've expressed it, the fact that your life is going to change in ways you don't know. And yeah. And this is reflected in Walter's career. He ends up with a job that wasn't what he thought it was going
to
be.
Yeah, Mid, his brother-in-law, turns out to be a sort of small-time empire owner. He owns those bikini and sunglasses gas stations. He owns a place called Island Pizza, and he owns these Twice the Ices, which have been popping up in Greensboro, and I've seen down in Florida, too. There's a sort of self-satisfied penguin sitting on a pile of ice, and you put your quarters in and get twice as much ice as you get at a gas station. That's the deal.
Island Pizza. Why is that good marketing? What makes you think that on an island the pizza is going to be good? I've never figured that out.
I don't know, but there's always one in every beach town. There's always Island Pizza, right?
How much of you of this anxiety is about your world going to be upended, the things that you've grown comfortable with, things you're not going to be able to do, and how much is, look, I have to train and prepare this child for a world that I'm not even ready for?
Oh, there's definitely that. You know, he's 3 and a half now, and he's got questions I don't know the answer to, existential questions I don't know the answer to. You know, Daddy, why isn't it raining anymore? When will it snow? How come X or Y makes me feel sad? And you just stand there and go, I don't know. Why don't we go play with blocks? Please come with me.
Well, they make you feel dumb, but also it's a dangerous world, and you think, oh, wow, how am I going to, you know, protect you against that?
Yeah, you know, when he was little, I mean, he's little now, but when he was two, when he first started falling down, he would hit the ground and yell angrily at the ground, no, because he didn't want the world to be the kind of place that could hurt him. And that, you know, was sort of simultaneously heartbreaking and, I confess, hilarious, which is always the line I'm trying to walk in these kinds of things.
You really don't want to laugh when your kid gets hurt.
No, you just turn away so he doesn't see.
Were you talking to other parents? Because, you know, parents have either answers or, I would say, rationalizations after the fact for why they had kids. And did any of this comfort you in the run-up to your fatherhood?
No, I think the opposite. There's a sort of cult of Broadway musical parenting with the exclamation point where you have to stand out back by the grill and say, this is the greatest thing that's ever happened to me. And all of our friends had kids before we did. And it is absolutely the greatest thing that ever happened to me. But it's also terrifying and scary and really hard. Like when I'm having a fight with him about whether or not he's going to go into the potty and he's saying, no, he won't. And I know, yes, he is. And I'm thinking, this is my life? This is what I'm doing with a 3 o'clock on a Saturday? Like, yeah, that's the space I want to make. I want to make more space for those kinds of conversations.
But it does change you. I mean, it turns out that giving up that baseball game, that baseball game did not make you as happy as this crazy circumstance of telling a child, oh, yes, you are, and how that makes you into somebody else.
Yeah, I wouldn't give either one of them back for anything. It absolutely exploded my heart, changed the way I saw the entire world. It's completely paradigm shift.
Parents, exclamation point.
Right.
Now showing a triad stage.
Maybe the Sweeney Todd version.
Well, let's get back to the book, because it's interesting. In a way, there's lots of, I mean, this is obviously a fun book, and it talks about things that all of us, or many of us who have faced parenthood, or any of us who may have had parents, probably have some experience with. But also, I think there's some cool elements in this in terms of Walter and Mid and the way they enact masculinity. I mean, there's a way of being a man in this book, or a couple of ways, right?
Yeah, I think there's this notion that you're supposed to quote-unquote man up, I guess, that you're supposed to figure out some way to find some combination of like the Leave It to Beaver dad with his feet up on the ottoman and then the sort of conquering Viking with the helmet and the horns. And I don't think either of those is a possible way of being in the world. Part of my concern with having a parent, or becoming a parent, and part of Walter's is too, is that he knows he's going to be an equal participant, that he knows I have to give up everything I know so that I can help this child at every possible turn. And I guess it comes to this sort of, we're in this kind of post or mid Mad Men conversation where we're having all these conversations about what masculinity looked like in the 1950s and what it looks like now. at some point we're going to have to stop having that conversation, and men are just going to have to cop to the fact that we feel things too. Women have been living a terribly complicated life for decades where they have to do things and feel things. It's probably time for men to do and feel at the same time too.
I'm not ready for that, but I take your point.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating to me that men are the ones who are worried about this when women are actually going to have the baby. And that
right.
kind of is the hard part.
Yeah, when I would tell my friends that we were pregnant, my wife would roll her eyes a little bit.
So what about the setting? Well, we're having you on this show as a Greensboro author, even though you chose not to set it in Greensboro, which is what's up with that?
Well, I set it in Florida, in the place where my family's vacationed for more than 30 years, this little town, Crescent Beach, just south of St. Augustine. But there's been this sort of conversation when I've been places talking about the book about, oh, you set it in wacky Florida. We vacation at the south-facing beaches in North Carolina, Oak Island, and those sorts of places. And I got to tell you, I think that there's a certain kind of beach towniness that is common to at least the beach towns of Florida and the beach towns of North Carolina. I absolutely am in love with the notion of beach town. It's a sort of more brightly lit version of the way that we regularly live
right.
our lives.
Yeah, the limits. It's kind of that you're living in this liminal world where some of the rules seem to be suspended.
Yeah. And right. if you're not having fun right now, you're doing something like you need to go rent a sailboard immediately and sort of push along with your life.
Would you read for us again?
Yeah, sure. This next scene takes place. Mid has a 15-year-old sort of semi-wayward daughter, Delton, who is a version of what Walter fears might be his future, and also what he hopes so desperately that he might get to have because she's smart and kind. She's in the back seat of a yellow Camaro in this scene. Even though I didn't want any part of being 15 again, I envied her all the same. Something about that age, young enough to still be a kid and know it, old enough to feel pretty certain that your problems weren't really kid problems anymore, and to find ways to enjoy wallowing in the pain of that, too. So your dad deals pot out of the back of his restaurant, and your mom kicks him out. Your phone lights and jumps 5 or 6 times on the way to a party with your dad and your drifter uncle, the screen filling with the Morse code of everyone you know, and when it goes off yet again, you hunch down further into the backseat of a monstrous car that might soon be yours, try to make yourself still more hidden. The things she probably typed back, LOL, SOS, or, just as likely somehow, I remain, as always, your humble servant. She was 2 months away from 16, 2 months from the open road and the endless dream of a better tomorrow, her few belongings tied into a bandana and slung over her shoulder, Huck Finn driving a yellow muscle car, smoking a pack of Winstons and wearing a tutu. As for me, I was 20-some weeks away from my daughter's arrival on the planet. I could feel the pressing weight of how little time that was. What I wanted to do was hand a spiral notebook and a pencil into the back seat and ask Delton to jot down, longhand, everything she knew. Should we make the BOJ take piano lessons? Gymnastics? When does a kid go to sleepover camp for the first time? When was the first time you remember being actually happy to play by yourself in your room or in the yard? And if we had one kid, did we have to have two? Was that some kind of rule? Just write it all down, please, I wanted to tell her. All of it. Write down everything I'm going to need to know.
Drew Perry reading from his novel Kids These Days.
Thank you.
As you're writing the book, what's your relationship with Walter?
I think, like most of my characters, Walter starts off as a version of me that I fear I might be or might become. And then once he becomes real enough on the page, he has his own demands. And so I'm not a big believer in the muse, you know, in sort of humming some note and hoping that I channel something onto the page. But once I start once I'm just trying to keep up with the characters on the page, I feel like I'm doing better work.
Did Walter have responses? Did Walter react to a situation differently than you did or think you might?
I would like to hope that I would get my life in order a bit more quickly than Walter does, but I'm afraid I might not, or that I didn't.
Yeah, but of course those are plot distinctions. Clearly you haven't, you know, had the ice machine experience that
right.
he has.
I have tried not to get involved in sort of small-time money laundering.
But no, if you're going to do it, go big.
Oh, you think?
That's the deal.
Okay.
But in terms of just his point of view and ways that he came to see his fatherhood, are you different, you and Walter?
Probably not. Yeah. Substantially. Probably our fears are the same. And I hope that we come around in the same way. Walter does manage by the end of the novel to try to get himself at least as prepared as one can be before the birth of the child. And I hope I got there.
And there's a kind of, you know, there's a sort of Everybody Loves Raymond quality to the male-female roles
right.
in all of this. And what about the women as you began to develop them? How thoroughly do you think you got female parts.
These women are based on the wives and mothers who would be at those cocktail parties that I would perform so poorly at, who seemed so much more than I did to have their lives figured out, who seemed remarkably to me at the time to be able to have a child and be at a cocktail party at the same time, which seemed absolutely impossible to me. It seemed so much to be one or the other. And so maybe we're back to that conversation about masculinity. Women have perhaps known how to do this all along, and now we're treating it like some kind of revelation that men are trying to figure it out too.
Isn't it sort of this great puzzle of the modern age that this is so hard for us? It's like the thing that we have always done, and we know that because we're here to think about it.
Right.
Right? And it has been obviously not easy to do, but it has never created the problems and the sort of complexity and neurosis that it does for us now, which is to give up some of our lives so that we can bring another one into the planet.
Maybe we have the space to think about it now. We're no longer the division of labor is no longer you hang onto the child and I'll go and stab the gazelles. Now we're all stabbing gazelles and all hanging onto the children and sort of doing it perhaps with a musical number behind us as we go. So
I can hear that now, actually, stabbing
but
gazelles.
Nothing rhymes with gazelle. You're doomed.
Yeah, I guess that's right. What did Oh, I can see them thinking. Look. There's a couple of answers right out there. We'll get it toward the end of the segment. What have you learned in writing this? Has anything changed for you in putting it together?
Well, as a writer, I think I have to reteach myself long form every time. The structures and scaffoldings of the way the novel is put together feels different to me. I've written two. I'm working on a third, and you have to sort of relearn the whole thing every time. As a father, I'm learning every single day that I have it figured out a little bit better than I thought I did, and that I don't understand a single thing at all.
There you go.
That the rules are forever shifting.
Yeah, that is it. You talked about wanting to write down the rules. If you've had two children, you know how fruitless that is. Because you had one, and you got it figured out. The second one comes along and says, watch this.
Right, I know. I so thought we had it down, and it turns out we don't. That's what Walter wants. He wants for somebody to come by and ring the doorbell and tell him it's all going to be all right. And, of course, that's never going to happen.
You say you're working on your third novel or?
Novel.
Child.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, we are completely finished.
So what are you working on? Tell us about the novel.
The new novel takes place in 1986 and 2003. It's bookended by the two space shuttle disasters. It's about a woman who discovers that her boyfriend is a domestic terrorist and that her father would like to fly to space in a homemade space capsule buoyed by weather balloons.
You're sure that hasn't been written already?
I'll add some gazelles.
Drew, what a pleasure. Thank you so much for talking with us. Drew Perry, his new book, The Kids These Days. Thank you very much, Drew, for being on the program. Drew Perry is a professor of creative writing at Elon University. As I said, the book is called Kids These Days. He's going to be giving a reading tonight at 7 o'clock at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill. And he's going to be at the Regulator Bookshop in Durham tomorrow. And you can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Coming up next, a live performance by Greensboro Symphony Orchestra music director Dmitri Sitkovetsky. And here's another excerpt from his 2004 performance of Beethoven's Violin Concerto. We will be right back. Stay tuned.
Italy can